Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Thursday, February 12th. I am Richard Benulli, your host, and today we have Louis Vincent Gave, Ira Harris, and Judd Hirschberg. Louis co-founded GaveCall in 1999 with his father, Charles Anatoly Kaletsky. Before co-founding GaveCall, Louis worked at Paribas Capital Markets, where he was equity research analyst from 1997 to 1999. And he studied economics, history, and Chinese at Duke University and Nanjing University. And Ira is a past hedge fund manager and a global trader of foreign currencies, bonds, and commodities, equities for over 40 years. He has served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also recently in 2019. We also have today Chief Investment Strategist Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading Strategies to help form the basis of some of the discussion with his charts and technical analysis indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Can you, my screen, good to see everybody.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you, see both of you. Oh, sorry, all three of you. Apologies, Judd.
Great. I thought we would begin, Louis, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Oh, wow. That's how much time do you have? Look, I think if you take a step back, for me, it's pretty obvious that we are in a reflationary environment and what we call an inflationary boom. You're everywhere around the world. Governments are following very easy fiscal policies. Central banks are kicking back. And so on the policy front, everything points to an inflationary boom. Then you look at markets and everything in the market also points to an inflationary boom. You have metals breaking out, financials outperforming in most markets, EM outperforming DM, both in bonds and in equities. You have commodity indices breaking out to the upside. And so we are in an inflationary boom. And then the question becomes, you know, what could derail it? And usually what derails inflationary booms is either a bond market meltdown. And we are seeing signs of that in Japan, but either a bond market meltdown or energy prices that spike up or central banks that start to tighten aggressively. Now that there's absolutely no sign that central banks are tightening aggressively. So I think you have to lean in on some of the trends that are working today, i.e. the outperformance of commodities, the outperformance of emerging markets. These are the trends that are working. And as of yet, there's no real reason to think they're going to stop working. I try to keep it short.
Sure. Yeah. Interesting. And just how about your thoughts, Ira? Are you aligned with that? What are you seeing?
I'm very much aligned with that. And yeah. I'll tell you this, Louis and I, probably about two months, he was nice enough to, we had a phone call and discussed the possibility of Canada and a sovereign wealth fund type of deal in Canada. I asked him about it because his knowledge is far deeper than mine and is, you know, sometimes from the south of the border, we look at Canada as a country without a people because it's so underpopulated relative to its size. And it is so rich in energy and minerals. You know, right now we're sitting at a precipice where people are talking about, you know, cutting out the what was NAFTA, which Trump had put together. But to me, that is so wrong-sided right now because they should be building more and more tighter relationships with Canada, especially with the rare earths and energy. And I, you know, that's when I talked to Louis about this, that I would, you know, for as much as Trump and many others talk about, for other countries to invest in the U.S., the U.S. should be doing exactly what they say. I would talk to Carney and say, look at why don't you start it with sovereign wealth fund? We'll put in $100 billion, whatever the number is, to secure and tighten up those lines so that there's more and more access to it. So I'm sure we'll get into that. The emerging markets, yes, you could see it in a lot of the, especially the commodity type currencies, even the, well, Canada's not doing, it was doing much better today, but it's still holding up pretty well. You are really starting to see, oh, look at the Australian dollar, the New Zealand dollar. So all of those, I am bullish Brazil. I think Brazil is also interesting because one thing about, I would say, and then we'll get into it. Lula has handled Trump very well. And I will raise this issue and I will hear Lewis speak to it. I thought, and I'm not a fan of Carney per se, and I'm certainly not a fan of Davos, but I really thought that the way Carney presented at Davos, he out-Trumped Trump because he raised everything to an elevated level like Trump wants to do, and then is in a position to walk it back to suit what his real purposes are. So I thought that was actually a very masterful job that Carney did. And it's probably a good point to jump off at.
What are your thoughts, Louis, on that, on for the Canadian Sovereign Wealth Fund? And
yeah, look, I think Carney is, you know what they say, the best way to look like a good prime minister in Canada is to come after Justin Trudeau. So Carney definitely has that going for him. And look, I think from everything, I do spend a lot of time in Canada, and from everything I'm hearing, Carney has actually won kudos, both within the administration in Ottawa, within the sort of the administrative arm of the government of Canada, but also in the provinces. You know, I even heard good things about Carney in Alberta from Albertans, which actually says a lot. I think there is an acknowledgement that he is trying to do some deregulation, that he is trying to move the ball forward. So he's been there a little over a year. And I think the next year is the really important one, to be honest, because what Canada needs, everybody knows that what Canada needs is to build the pipelines through BC, to build the LNG terminals in the Maritimes so that you can sell natural gas to Europe and you can sell the oil to Asia and essentially stop being so dependent on the US for everything. Now, if Carney manages to do that, I think he will go down in history as a great prime minister. It's that simple. And if he doesn't manage to do that, then what's the point? I think there's a window of opportunity today within Canada, a genuine desire and willingness to reduce the dependency on the United States, for obvious reasons. The U.S. has not been a good friend. And so if Carney can't capitalize on this moment, you know, if he cannot push through the construction of this critical infrastructure for Canada's long-term economic well-being. If he can't do that, then I think his premiership will have been a failure. And if he can do it, his premiership will have been a massive success. So it's very binary. And I think we'll know in the next year. I keep hearing, I'm a little disappointed it hasn't happened yet, to be honest, but at the same time, I keep hearing that a lot of work is being done in the background and that this is going to happen soon. And again, I think if it happens, this will have a big market impact. It will be super bullish Canadian assets, especially I think it'll be very bullish the Canadian dollar, because Canada will stop having to sell its oil at a discount. Canada will stop having to sell its natural gas at a discount. Canada will become a true economic power, not dependent on just one economy. You know the old truth that if you only have one client, which is essentially the situation that Canada's in today, if you only have one client, you don't have a client, you have a boss. That's the situation that Canada's in today. And Carney, I think, has the cards to change that. And I'm hopeful, as someone who's long Canadian assets, you know, my wife is Canadian, my kids are Canadian. I'm hopeful that this happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those good points, observations. And I think, Ira, you mentioned you were analyzing the Ballard company power, Ballard Power in Canada, yeah, and potential alignment with China, right, for development of technology, EVs,
Well, China already owns and has for a long time owned 25% of Ballard. I didn't realize it until an FT article back in, I think, 2019. And it had me buying. When I read it, I said, I had no idea that, especially because China was doing so much work with hydrogen, with hydrogen energy. So it made perfect sense. And also, again, if you were putting together, and again, this is loose talk because we'd have to go through the intricacies of Canadian law to see how this would structure, especially with the way the provinces are structured and how much power reverts back to the provinces. But, you know, I love Lewis's line. You want to be a great prime minister, just follow Macron. And I would add his sidekick, Freeland. Because they were classic examples of what I fear most. When I tell people, when you believe your own bullshit, you're really in trouble. And Macron was one who believed that. And
you
I think
Trudeau, although Macron as well, but I think you mean Trudeau.
I mean, not Carney, Trudeau. Yeah. Carney did for a little while until he saw the mess that he made. And he goes, you know what? Now this ain't working. And if people want to buy energy, it's like when Germany came in search of energy right after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and Trudeau rebuffed them. You know, they know. What do you mean? They're going to get it from somewhere. So if you did a master equation of the pluses and minuses, so if you say no, that just means, and what did Germany do? They're burning more coal because you're going to have to do whatever you can to generate power because every economy works on power. And you're going to have to do it at such a cost that your population is at least willing to follow you. So we have China burning more coal. We have Germany burning coal, and they burn that brown coal, which is the dirtiest of all. So from a global perspective, you're an abject failure. So that's when I say, when you believe your own bullshit, you really get into trouble. And Trudeau was one who believed it and walked down that line. And Carney said, yeah, because I think he came in and he said, this is far worse than I thought. And he's been trying. And Lewis's line is just great. So that was a good jumping off point. And I agree. And then we're not even to the rare earths. And they have the rare earth processing center in Saskatchewan, I believe it is. And they can build more. And they have enough rare earth. And then you have a rare earth potential, up in Northeast Canada, which, and not, I mean, Northeast Alaska, which proves out too. So you got Trilogy, which, you know, there is so much to build on there. Stop pretending that the world is going to be carbon, zero carbon by 2035, and get with the program and at least allow your people to have an opportunity to really accumulate some wealth. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if we stay in this hemisphere for continuing the discussion, Louis, looking at Latin America, what are your thoughts on how it evolves from an economic and investment environment, given you have Trump U.S. administration on the one hand looking at the doctrine of the Western Hemisphere, but then there's been a lot of investment by China. How is that going to develop, and will you still stay bullish on Latin America in that regard?
Yeah, so I have been a raging bull on Latin America, so much so that as a firm, we actually started to co-manage a Latin America debt fund. And last year was a monster year for Latin American debt. Bond yields all around the region fell 100 to 250 basis points, depending on the country. Latin American debt basically rallied about 35%. It was a monster year. And this year is starting off just the same. Now, I think this represents actually a super important fundamental change in the Latin American debt markets, which will have ramifications for all asset classes, because there is no more potent force for equities, for real estate, for consumption, than falling interest rates, right? And you take a country like Brazil, as you go from interest rates of 16 down to 14, then down to 12, then down to 10, this is a huge tailwind for for everything, for growth, for asset prices. The reality is that, you know, when interest rates are 16%, people aren't going to borrow money to buy a car or even to buy a house. When interest rates are at 8, they definitely do. So the fall of interest rates across the region corresponds to many different factors. You know, success has many fathers and all that. But the one new overwhelming factor is indeed the one you just alluded to, namely the fact that the new Donroe Doctrine, for quote unquote, the fact that the U.S. essentially, having lost the trade war with China, having lost in its attempt to box China technologically in, I think the U.S. is retreating to the borders of Fortress America or Fort Monroe or the Western Hemisphere, call it whatever you want to call it, saying, look, we've got this huge area here where we have all the commodities we could possibly need, all the cheap labor we could possibly need, and defending this Western Hemisphere is very easy and will cost us very little. And you've seen this new Donroe Doctrine applied in different ways. So for Argentina, you know, Argentina was about to go bust this summer, as it does every 10 to 15 years. And the U.S. government steps in and says, okay, here's $20 billion, here's another $40 billion. We're backstopping you. Obviously, then you have the regime change in Venezuela, or sorry, the removal of Maduro, because the regime actually more or less stays the same. But the reason I think this matters and matters tremendously is that if you look at historically in Latin America, the problem was always that every 10, 15, 20 years, Latin American countries somehow ran out of dollars. And I think they ran out of dollars partly because locals themselves typically don't trust their own politicians. And so when they, as soon as you make money, you move it to Miami, you move it to Madrid, you move it to Geneva. And so there's very much a sort of conquistador / latifundista mentality amongst the elites of Latin America, where I make money here. And as soon as I make money here, I get the money out rather than reinvesting it locally. And because of that, every 10, 15, 20 years, the place would run out of dollars and countries would go bust. And therefore, you'd ask for a huge risk premium to invest there. Now that the U.S. is coming in and saying, you're not going to run out of money, we're going to backstop you. If you run out of dollars, we'll come in with loans. You won't have to go to the IMF. You just call the U.S. Treasury and we'll wire you some cash. You know, you've essentially removed the biggest risk to investing in Latin America. And in so doing, the risk premium on bonds can come down. So that was the big story of last year. It's I think that's still a story that's going to play out for the next 2-3 years. For the next 2-3 years, every year, bond yields around the region are going to fall 100, 150, 200 basis points. So if you want to own bonds anywhere, you definitely want to own them in Latin America. And so as a result, I think Latin America has essentially started what we in our firm call a triple merit scenario, a period of falling real interest rates, rising exchange rates, and rising asset prices. And when you have these triple merit scenarios, consumption ends up being very strong and economic activity very buoyant. So I think Latin America is the one region where, frankly, you probably can't be bullish enough, whether on debt, whether on equities, whether on overall economic growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good points, observations. And Ira, you mentioned Brazil also earlier.
Yeah, I can't agree. First of all, let me just say this, that Lewis and Gavkell have been is right on this between emerging market bonds, because I emerging market stocks, they have been. And last time I think we were on with Lewis, and I look at the stocks that Lewis and I agreed on. We were looking at the agriculture company. We loved Bunge. We both discussed Bunge together. We looked at the Japanese financials as well as some other Asian financials. We thought Asia was a far underinvested territory in this. In fact, I will say that my favorite Mitsubishi Tokyo actually broke $20 today for the first time. Maybe ever. You know, it's just had a really nice, solid run here. As in your UBI, all the things that we've discussed, and now, and I don't think, you know, again, if you want to baseball it, where are we? Well, I would say we're still early in that. And you could see it. You know, Brazil, and when Lewis talks about Brazil runs real yields of what, 10%, 11%? What, they're so astronomical. So there's plenty of room to cut rates in Brazil, especially once they get a little bit more of their stuff together and they get, and Lula is still successfully handling Trump in the way that he does. And that's not a pejorative statement. I mean, you just have to learn how this works and to work with it. China's put so much money in there. Japan is certainly going to put more money in there. The Japanese have a long affinity and close relationship. So much of the agricultural land in Brazil has been owned by Japanese for probably 100 years. They go back a long way. Brazil's rich in all types of resources, just like Canada, but they have greater population and they have a more sensitive ecological system that needs protecting. So that will be limited. But I look at Petrobras, you know, nice dividend. And we'll get into this, I'm sure, because I'm going to pique Lewis's mind. But so we look at Petrobras, which has been terribly managed because it was a slush fund for everybody in Brazil of the elites. So if they start to manage it better, I think it's a really great growth story. And listen, I'm with Lewis. I think Latin America, South America is really a really good story in so many ways. And everybody's looking at what's going on in Argentina, because if he actually gets successful, it will be interesting, because I think you'll see more turn to pragmatism and rather than all these ideologically driven administrations that we've seen, you know, certainly since for a long time. But you know, I'm older than you, but I go back to Allende, and I wore a button probably for 10 years in my life. Allende sí, junto no. So I go back a long way with the Allende regime.
You're dating yourself.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think the Chilean coup, I was definitely in short shorts. I think it was in 79, the
73. Santiago coup. 73. Well, he came to power. Allende came to power in 73. Yeah, it was probably 78 with
79, the coup. Yeah. So I was in short shorts for sure.
Yeah. Any particular markets that you favor in Latin America, South America, like Colombia, Brazil, Chile, Argentina? Yeah.
So, look, I think Chile right now has the wind in its sails. First, Chile has always been very dependent on copper, of course. It's the world's biggest copper exporter. I'm also very bullish on copper. So it's hard to be bullish on copper and not be bullish Chile. So the two sort of go hand in hand. At the same time, you've just had a political transition that has gone very peacefully in Chile, and you now have a government that is much more, let's call it Trump adequate, which always helps, because that means you will definitely get the U.S. backstop if you need it. Not that they'll need it with the price of copper where it is. So if you look at Chile, the problem for Chile is always, what's the price of copper and what's the price of energy? Because they're a big energy importer. So the best environment for them is a high price of copper and a low price of energy, which is exactly, and a low price of oil, which is exactly where you stand today. So they're very much in the sweet spot. To some extent, the same can be said of Peru. There's an additional advantage for both Peru and Colombia. Is historically, Peru and Colombia have dealt with very violent, extreme left terrorism movements that have essentially been funded by Venezuela. And so to some extent, one could hope, if you look at what's just happened in Venezuela, the indirect consequence of that should be that the terrorism funding in both Colombia and Peru just falls off a cliff. So, mm-hmm. So I think that's a second important development. Colombia has an election coming up in a couple months or in a few months, and here that provides some uncertainty in that it's really neck and neck, and the leftist president today, Petro, is doing all he can to push his own candidate over the line, i.e. spending a lot of money, as they say in Spanish, getting fat today on tomorrow's bread. So whoever comes in following the election is going to have a bit of a fiscal situation. So Colombia, I think it's a little hard to get really fired up on. But to Ara's point, the real elephant in the room is Brazil, because, you know, how much are you going to really put in Chile or in Peru? The real elephant in the room is Brazil, where interest rates, real rates are indeed super high, partly because of the political uncertainty. Essentially, you have a three-horse race. On the one hand, Lula, and who's the left-wing candidate, and the markets probably wouldn't react great to a Lula win. Bolsonaro's son, who's supposedly running, I think he's just positioning himself to be a vice president on the Tarcísio ticket. So the market would love a Tarcísio win. If it turns out to be a runoff between Bolsonaro and Lula, the market probably won't like it. Because it will be very polarizing. It will be very, it won't give confidence to foreign investors. So in both Brazil and Colombia, I think right now you have a sort of political overhang. The good news is this political overhang disappears over the next 9 to 10 months.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Interesting. Moving to Japan, to what extent do you see it being a big impact on the global economy and the financial markets in terms of the trends in the currency, Japanese yen, Japanese JGBs, government bonds, the yield going higher? Potential unwinding of the Japanese yen carry trade?
So I've been a bit surprised by the market reaction to Takahashi's, you know, frankly, massive win. I looked at that. I thought, you know, on Sunday night, I thought the markets would open with, JGB yields up 25 basis points because she's fiscally very, very dovish. You know, she just wants to spend a bunch of money, and she especially wants to spend a bunch of money on defense, which is, you know, not really the most productive way to spend a bunch of cash. Not only that, she's very keen on tying up Japan further with the United States. So spend a bunch of money, essentially buying a bunch of U.S. weapons, which strikes me as being, you know, quite bearish JGBs and bearish yen. Now, I was surprised that JGB market. So I thought the yields on Japan would go up 20, 25 basis points on this win. They ended up going up 7 or 8 basis points. So the reaction of the market was in the right direction, but it was not nearly as extreme as I expected it to be. Now you could say, well, the market had already priced it in. The JGBs had already sold off beforehand, et cetera, et cetera. The second thing, since she's been elected, the yen has actually strengthened a good bit. And I think the yen strengthening is all the more surprising in that if you look at yesterday where you had a big yen move, a full figure, it occurred right in the face of stronger U.S. jobs data. Now, we can debate how strong the U.S. jobs really were. You know, if you strip out this, if you strip out that, then it doesn't look as great, et cetera. But the yen still rose on against a backdrop where it shouldn't have. So I wonder if there's government leaning on the pension funds, government leaning on the banks. Look, don't sell the bonds, buy back the yen. Or if we are starting to see, so that's one option. And that's my inclination, to be perfectly frank. That's what I think is happening. But my level of conviction is not super high. You know, you look at things, it's like, oh, where do I believe this is what's happening? And I really think that's what's happening. Or I believe it's happening, but maybe I'm wrong, kind of thing. The other option is maybe the pension funds, the insurance companies are repatriating money because yields have now gotten high enough. And so they have started, and therefore the yen's going up. The way I'd put it for me personally is that I think Japan is increasingly, for me, in an increasingly hard category because you're going to have very unorthodox fiscal policy going forward where, you know, the consequences of which could go in any number of directions. And so when I look at Japan, I can understand why people are long Japanese equities. That part makes sense. The yen, the JGB market, I think it's very tough. I struggle to see why the JGB markets would rally in the face of this government. I can easily understand why the JGB market would keep going down. And so my concern is that if bond yields in Japan continue to rise, and I think that's the most likely scenario, that's, you know, that acts like an anchor, that's like an anvil around the neck of government bond markets everywhere. Like, how can U.S. Treasury yields come down? How can German bund yields come down if JGB yields are going up? And I don't think they can. So that's my take on it. And to be very clear, I don't have very big positions in Japan at all today. I think there's easier trades out there. I think Latin America is a much easier trade. I think China is a much easier trade. I think Hong Kong is a much easier trade. So there's trades out there that seem to me simpler than Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good observations. And Ira, supported by your son's analysis too, right, with his Substack mm-hmm. on Japan, what are your thoughts on the impact of Japan?
Yeah, I'm really fortunate that I have somebody who I, just like Lewis's father, I have given birth to somebody who's very knowledgeable on Japan, fluent in the language, and is really was detailing out the election day to day on, as you said, on Substack, and I appreciate that. But Japan is an interesting place because the carry trade to me is still in force. And I don't care how many people come on CNBC. The fact that the yen is at 35-year lows against the euro, all-time lows against the Swiss franc, it's been because of the carry trade. And then you had Bessent about 8 or 9 days, 10 days before the election, making little bits of noise about, well, you know, the Treasury, you know, will the Treasury intervene? And we've seen that. There's a playbook from 1998 in June with when Bob Rubin was treasurer and the U.S. Treasury intervened to support the yen as Bill Clinton et al. Were on their way in the plane to Beijing. And that led to interesting trades in the yen because the yen was really weak and the Chinese were complaining about how weak it is. There's discussions about that. There's a lot of people in Asia, and I think rightfully so, who believe that the weak yen is causing some problems from South Korea through others. But I have, you know, we've talked about, I don't know whether Lewis and I talked about it, it's been a while, but I've talked on this podcast, whoever I was with many times, the euro yen is far too weak for Europe. Too strong. The euro is far too strong against the yen. And it's really, to me, hampering Europe. Because at 185, which we started out the week, and I agree with Lewis. I was expecting a sell-off in JGBs Sunday night. I was traveling. I was on a plane, so I didn't know what was happening, but I expected a large sell-off. I thought the Nikkei would rally because Takeuchi is, you know, she's I would probably say Ronald Reagan without the Ronald Reagan in a skirt, because she wants to spend a lot on defense and she wants to ramp up other types of infrastructure spending, even with Japan's bad situation. But I think Lewis's point about why is the yen rallying, I think because, don't forget, the Japanese have so much money invested around the world. What's the number? $3 trillion, $4 trillion? If they brought 25% of it home to support the Japanese economy and Takeuchi and what she wants to do, that's not a small fund. In fact, when I look at the board today, because that would create a serious, sell off in a lot of assets, because the Japanese have invested in so many assets, especially. It'll be interesting to see where they come out of, because
On this, sorry to interrupt you, but I think
something
very important happened in Korea over the holidays. So most people missed it, but essentially Korea changed their taxation laws where they said, okay, if you have assets abroad and you bring them back now and you reinvest them at home, you for a small window, you won't have to pay capital gain. So let's say you own a bunch of Microsoft stock, bring it home, and you don't have to pay your capital gains on Microsoft to the Korean government. And better yet, if you reinvest it at home, let's say you buy Samsung or SK Hynix or whatever else, you won't have to pay capital gains on your Korean assets. And I think that's going to be a trend, because Pierre Poilievre actually suggested this in Canada during the last election, where he said, hey, you invest in Canada, you don't pay capital gains in Canada. You invest abroad, we charge capital gains on that. Korea essentially just adopted this. And of course, the Korean market is going bananas. And I think that's one of the factors. Koreans have been huge buyers of Mag 7, of software stocks, of NASDAQ, of the ARK funds. They've loved all the tech stuff in the US. And I think that's one of the reasons why tech stocks in Korea have been going bananas and tech stocks in the US have been going nowhere. Now, imagine if Japan did the same thing. But to be very clear, I have absolutely no indication and no inside knowledge that Japan is thinking of doing the same thing. But if I'm Takeuchi, I'm looking at what Korea just did. And essentially, the Korean market is up 100% over the past year. I'm looking at what Korea just did. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe I'll have me some of that. At least that's what I would do. So just throwing that out there as a potential event to think about.
You know what? Interrupt all day long with that, Lewis. That's right. And you could see it in the Korean won is all of a sudden, right? It has definitely developed a little something here. So they're willing for it to strengthen. And nothing says it more than the Chinese yuan strengthening, which I know we'll get into because it's not something that you haven't seen. But to this avail, because a lot of people said, the way that they're going to fight back against Trump is with the depreciating yuan. Well, they were as wrong as they were at the beginning of COVID when everybody was looking for the Chinese to depreciate the yuan, when the absolute inverse happened and we went down to about 6.10 on the dollar yuan. Because why? Because the Chinese were busy during that time of a massive downturn in commodity prices. They were busy stockpiling everything. I know we did a podcast, I think in 21 or 22 with Richard, but they were massive buyers. And so they actually pursued a strong yuan policy, because when you're buying everything that's dollar denominated, it was a brilliant maneuver. Now, there are things going on here. I don't know, but if I'm the Europeans, I'm not happy. You know, I think back to when we had, with the Plaza Accord, when he was Secretary of Treasury, and he put together the Plaza Accord. Why? Because the dollar was way too strong. James Baker, strong. Yeah. And where's the voice of that? Because there's no question on many, yes, I know about the fiscal situation in Japan, but relative to their massive amount of savings, I would argue that they're in a better shape than a lot of Western countries. And going back to Canada, Canada's fiscal position is far better than a lot of others too, which makes, I agree with you on the Canadian dollar. What will ignite it? I don't know. It'll take some real foresight from Carney. But the Japanese...
All Carney needs to do, if he wants a stronger Canadian dollar, and I'm not sure he does, but all he needs to do is to announce the IPO of the Canadian airports. And then every, you know, La Caisse, BCIMC, Ontario Teachers, they'll love buying into that. All these big guys, Canada has massive pension funds, massive, very well-funded pension funds that are desperate for Canadian dollar assets. And they just don't have enough Canadian dollar assets. So if you give it to them, if you give them assets such as the airports that the government could easily privatize, they'll happily buy them. And instead of investing in the U.S., they'll invest at home. I think all these guys keep telling the Carney government, give us stuff to buy, like build the pipelines. We'll give you money for them. Give us stuff to buy.
Yeah. You know, hence said when we talked about the sovereign, you know, it makes such perfect sense. And there is capital all over the place. And again, all the capital of Japan, retail investors, pension funds, banks, that is spread all over the world. They have that ability. So based on their savings, you know, everybody in the United States, like, you know, what's his name, was throwing out some numbers the other day, $200 trillion in assets to back up the balance sheet. Slow down. So you know what? Yeah, that's right. it becomes a silly discussion at times, but that's not so for the Japanese. They do have assets, and I look at the Europeans. Well, the Europeans have such massive amount of problems. I'm really shocked that people pour in there. I mean, it would be one thing if European assets were cheap, but I would argue at this juncture they were cheap, but they're not so cheap now. So I would take a breath and see what's going on. You know, Christine, well, I don't want to get ahead of that, but so what happens in Japan with Takeuchi? But I think that she's been scared off because I think she almost had that modern monetary theory. You know, that's what they talked about, that she was an advocate of it for years. But that doesn't work. And the world, I think she will make too many enemies if the yen stays weak. Again, it's just a hypothesis, and it's my hypothesis based on what I've known and the way Japan operates. Now, if I was Ueda running the bank, you know, we talk about central bank independence. That's a joke and a half. But if I was independent, if I was Ueda, I would raise overnight rates at my next meeting to 1.5%. That's a 75 basis point raise, and say, here's where we're staying. And I'll bet even money with anybody that the JGBs over a 7-day period actually rally. Because as long as the Japanese are sustaining a negative real yield regime, which they've liked because it supports the whole concept of the carry trade, that would fold up like a house card. And you wouldn't even have to intervene in the market. The market is still short yen. I don't care. I don't care again what comes on CNBC. I don't care what's on Bloomberg. I don't care what's on Fox. Oh, the carry trade is over. No chance in the world is it over. They've just got way too much money, and it's been based on the true concept of the carry trade. And I'll add that one of my favorites, Rosenzweig and Gehring, you know, they put out in their last quarterly piece the end of the anti-carry trade. So they see this too in a much more deeper perspective about, you know, what it craves. And that should be over. And the Japanese should want it to be over. I'm not saying push the yen back down to 75 yen to the dollar. But I know that corporate Japan, based on their projections, can live very comfortably at 120 to 125. And I think that would go a long way to lifting Takeuchi, because all of a sudden, I think you would start to see inflation decline with a stronger yen and a more aggressive BOJ.
Mm-hmm. Actually, speaking of currencies in Asia, I think you've recently expressed bullishness this year on Asian currencies in general. Louis, could you elaborate on that? Is that the case?
Absolutely. Look, I think for me, the single most important macro development this year, amidst all the noise about Greenland, amidst all the noise about Venezuela, et cetera, Iran, the single most important macro development for me, actually, that no one's talking about is if you look at the past 50 trading session, the renminbi has gone up 45 out of the past 50 trading session, which is, I think, a pretty clear signal from the PBOC, the Chinese Central Bank, that they're moving the currency higher. You know, they didn't just fall asleep at the wheel, and you don't get 45 up days out of 50 without the Chinese clearly signaling something. And what they're doing is they're signaling to their exporters, importers, and the like, look, the renminbi is moving up from here on out to hedge your currency. And it matters a lot. It matters a lot. So here I see Ira putting up the chart or Judd putting up the chart. Obviously, when it's going down, that means the renminbi is going up. For the listeners, when the renminbi goes from 7.15 to 6.9, that means the renminbi is going up. We are now entering a period of renminbi moving up, which matters because it matters tremendously in terms of the allocation of Chinese savings. I'll give you an example. Where I live in Hong Kong, over the past few years, we've had roughly $500 billion increase in U.S. dollar bank deposits in Hong Kong. Now, clearly, this is not Hong Kong money. You know, we didn't just wake up and find $500 billion U.S. dollars in the sofa. All this money that is showing up in Hong Kong is essentially Chinese money. And it was coming because if you were a Chinese guy and you could get your money into Hong Kong, you would get 5% interest rate at ICBC or at Bank of China or at HSBC or Standard Chartered. And the renminbi was falling 3-4% a year. So that means that in renminbi terms, you were earning 8-9% a year. And remember, inflation in China is zero. So if you can make 8 or 9% real, you know, that's without any volatility, without any risk, this is pretty good. This is, you know, it's much better than a punch on the nose, which is what you've been getting if you've been investing in Chinese real estate or until recently Chinese equities. So that was a super, super compelling investment proposition for a lot of Chinese people. Now, having said that, imagine now that, you know, you're no longer earning 5% interest rates. You're now earning 3.5%. You're probably on your way to 2%. And at the same time, instead of going down 3% a year, the renminbi is now going to go up 5-7% a year. So what was a plus 8 trade is now suddenly a -2-3% trade. So now you're sitting on US dollar cash deposits in Hong Kong, and you're thinking how to do something else with them. And there's $1.1 trillion in cash at the bank in Hong Kong. And I think that money is slowly starting to leak out and essentially buying high-yielding Chinese stocks. And that's providing a huge undertow and for the Chinese equity markets, and especially for the Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong that offer high dividend yields.
Mm-hmm. Ira, bullish on Asian currencies, yeah.
It's just great. There's nothing else to say about it. But I'm going to bring in with it because I know we're on a time here. Mm-hmm. Louis, I would bring in and Judd put it up. I think this is a very important chart, which will help tell us about Asian currencies. The Swiss currency is the most interesting currency in the world to me right now, because here's a currency that's begging to be weaker. Zero interest rates, negative on the two-year yield, and all the currency does is strengthen. Because to me, that's the canary in the coal mine on people's psychological bent on sovereign debt and what the world faces. Because listen, the Swiss are nothing but good fiduciaries of their currency. And that's not even including the massive holdings that the S&P. The S&P, as I've maintained for 15 years, they're the greatest alchemists in the world. They print Swiss francs, they convert them to other currencies, and they buy the equities. This S&P is sitting on a massive amount of money. Now, that's not Swiss. Swiss government money per se, because SNB is actually a privately owned institution, but by law, they have to pass all that dividend gain and stuff to the cantons. So the Swiss is very interesting, but on a weekly chart, the Swiss yen, the Swiss made all-time highs against the yen this week. And we are interesting because, from my perspective, and again, my perspective, we're below last week's low at 199.11 on the Swiss yen. It's not an exact science, but that's pretty close. Let's see where this closes tomorrow. Because the Swiss is, you know, it's like right now, it's up a little bit on the day. And that's what the metals getting hit pretty good since we started talking. The gold's dropped $120 since we started talking. I don't know what you did to it, Lewis, but something.
No.
But I would watch this closely because the Swiss are begging for their currency to be weakened, especially against the euro. And that's also at some very low levels. So in regards to Asia, I think that Swiss yen becomes a very, very important cross, and especially because the Japanese and the Swiss really do compete in a lot of areas, high-end pharma, high-end optics, high-end machine tools. They're very competitive. So the Swiss would like to get that currency down. They've been unable to do it, and the Swiss are smart enough not to push against that giant wave. They look for their moments to intervene. When the Swiss is already showing a little weakness, they'll jump on it. But this will be very interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great insights and discussion. You just wanted to bring it to a close here. Your final thoughts, Louis, in terms of and how can our listeners learn more about your work as well? Yep.
So my final thought is as we're talking, the Dow is now back below 50,000. So it's good news, because that means the U.S. Department of Justice can start going after pedophiles. So that's something we can all hopefully all rejoice in.
50,000.
Now that we're back below 50,000, we should start putting pedophiles in prison. So that's good news. And if people want to find out about us, they can go to our website, gavekal.com, G-A-V-E-K-A-L. That's probably the best place.
Mm-hmm. Great. Awesome. Thanks. And Ira.
This is, you find me here. I'm not going to be doing many more of these because Richard, you and I have talked. And I know next week we have one with, this is a really good way for me to end this with Lewis, and then followed up by His Eminence, Mark Faber, is next Thursday, I believe.
Yeah.
So this is really, it doesn't get any better than this for me. I read the letters, the stuff that Lewis puts out, wherever he gets interviewed, I find my way to it. They post it all the time on Haymaker, so I always catch him wherever he gets. I have ways to find him. So I would tell everybody, if you're looking for a place, an investment advisor, go to GabCal. It'll give you world, and in a world where you need greater world exposure, they do it. I don't have money there, so I'm not selling myself. I'm just telling you that when it comes to paying attention to what's going on in the world, here you are. So, Lewis, this has been great.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Jess.
And, Chad, if you can put your contact details. And great. Yeah, thanks very much, Louis, Ira, and Chad. Thank you.
Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.